Hello, and welcome back to Film Baby Film, the podcast for people who love movies, or films if you're being pretentious. I'm your host, John Lobager, and I'm joined today by Matthew Sparadolosi, actor and criminal defense attorney. I guess he's probably a criminal defense attorney first, because that's the way he spends most of his time, but he also does acting, live performances, as well as doing audiobooks, and just overall a really smart guy, a really great guy to talk to. And today we talk about Fritz Lang's 1931 black and white early sound film called M. M is a classic, ranked on lots of lists as one of the best movies ever made. It's also really an important film. Fritz Lang was a well-known silent film director, and this is his first movie featuring sound. And it's one of those great leaps forward, because not only does it use sound, it really highlights how sound can be used effectively as movie grammar. And so it's kind of amazing that this was the first sound film that the director had made, and he utilized it so effectively, so quickly. We not only talk about some of the cool technical aspects, as well as some of the interesting things that happen in the movie, but we also spend some time talking about what is Matthew's expertise, which is criminal defense work, and we also touch on some of the ethical issues that arise in the film around defending clients who sometimes are guilty, sometimes are not, and the ethical issues that arise out of that. And it's one of those things that people a lot of people still debate to this day. And so really, it's a great conversation. Absolutely, if you can, listen to the entire episode all the way to the end. Matthew does a great job of talking about the issues around the ethics of criminal defense work, and then tells us about some of the recent work that he's been doing, setting some precedents that could potentially result in a lot of people being a lot of innocent people that have been convicted or been put behind bars potentially being freed because of the work that he's done. So it's a really awesome conversation. I think you're going to enjoy it. So I'm just going to get right to it. Film Baby Film, discussing Fritz Lang's movie M with Matthew Sparadolosi. Let's do it. Welcome, everybody, to Film Baby Film, podcast for people that love movies, or films if you're being pretentious. Today, I am discussing the movie M, Fritz Lang's 1931 black and white classic, with Matthew Sparadolosi. Did I say it right, Matthew?
Yes, you did.
And Matthew, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and why I asked you to come on the podcast to discuss M?
I think we've known each other for all the way back to UMass days, or maybe even before that. I've been an actor pretty much my whole life. I record audiobooks, but also I think for this particular podcast, the fact that I'm a criminal defense attorney is significant in the way that I view the themes that came up in the movie. So that's probably the main reason.
And so was this your first time watching M?
It was, yeah. I had never even heard of it before.
Okay, so I actually think I know that I'd heard of Fritz Lang when I was in like middle school. Somebody had told, like, one of my teachers, like my fourth grade teacher, I think, told me about Metropolis, which was his big film before this. And maybe I knew about M after that, but I certainly hadn't seen it until recently. But as soon as I saw it, it's funny because I think you had an article that you had posted on Facebook about some defense work you had done, getting DNA evidence thrown out of a case, like very shortly after I had watched the movie, and I was so excited about the idea of talking to you specifically about this movie.
Oh, right. I didn't know that was the timing behind that.
Yeah, I had just seen this movie recently, and this is a classic film. This is considered one of the great early films, and Fritz Lang is considered one of the great early directors. So this is a fantastic film, and I feel like you're the perfect guy to talk about it with and get another perspective on it.
Yeah, it was really good. I mean, you could tell that it was definitely, right at the, verge of the silent film era to the sound film era. It was like right on the cusp there, and that was obvious watching it.
Yeah, but, it's funny because a movie that's so opposite of it, but I always think of, I thought of Singing in the Rain when I was watching it because I felt like this was an example of that, a person that had worked in the silent era, them making the transition and doing it with sound. And it's funny, I just think of that. I think of a movie totally different from it, but that reminded me of it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, ultimately, when you talk about silent films versus sound films, the objective is just to tell a story. And the audience is going to be entertained if you tell a good story. And it really doesn't matter if there's sound or not. I mean, as long as the story is good and told well, and the director uses whatever tools they have to tell the story, then it's powerful. And I thought this movie was a good example because, obviously this movie being made in 1931 didn't have any explosions or superheroes or anything like that. It was just a good story, and that's all it was.
Although maybe the producers would have wanted some more explosions or superheroes, but Fritz Lang wasn't gonna sell out. So tell me a little bit about what you. So why don't you introduce everybody to the movie? I'm sure most people listening to this have already seen it, but why don't you talk a little bit about the movie? Set the stage so we can talk about some of those themes that we had discussed.
Yeah. So basically, there is it's in Germany, right? There's a serial killer who's basically killing children, I guess, is what's going on. And the start of the movie is when the serial killer kind of intercepts and kidnaps this girl, and there's this drama with her balloon and sort of flying away, and all you can see is her balloon. I think there's also like a bouncing ball that bounces away into nowhere. And then
really dramatically set up. You could certainly see, even though it's like an expert use of sound, you could still see some of that just purely visual language communicating without showing any violence against a child, that something, that innocence was being lost here. Something really bad was happening.
Right, exactly. And then, this was just the latest in a string of murders. And then the rest of the movie, or the good portion of the movie thereafter, is the hysteria that pursues, once, the it's identified that there's a huge problem in this society, that being a murderer is on the loose. And the hysteria causes the town and the people in the town to abandon many of their core values because they're so desperate to catch the guy. And then, there's such weird symbolism with the blind man, and of course, spoilers, right, in case you haven't seen it, but how they end up catching the guy is he's whistling some tune when he purchases that first victim at the beginning of the movie, a balloon. And then later, he's whistling that same tune, and the balloon vendor is blind, but he recognizes the tune, and that's how they end up catching the guy. And just like blind justice, right? Like, or even, the one eyewitness against you
is a blind man. Yeah,
is literally blind. So there is some obvious symbolism there.
And even in terms of where Fritz Lang was at in terms of going from silent films to talkies, there's people with sight. Who are, visually hunting down clues, but then the inspectors and the detectives. But then there's the blind man who the only clue that he has is an auditory clue. So it also has that element of it as well.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, they identify him with that tune, and then they bring him to the kangaroo court, which is, you know, the sort of the climax of the movie and kind of wraps up all these themes. But there wasn't that much evidence against the guy besides, you know, he did confess at the end. And if it wasn't for the confession, I'm thinking, how are they going to convict this guy? So what, he's sang the same tune that the other guy did. It's a popular song, you know?
Yeah, you almost, I mean, they had to have Peter Lorre give that speech mostly so that you could see, because it's interesting, he almost recreates, not almost, I mean, he really does, he acts out what it's like to have the urge, to have the, you know, criminal hunger that he would have, and then to actually give in to that. He, like, reenacts it step by step. So there's a part of me that wishes that there wasn't the confession to almost make it even more ambiguous, even though we know that Peter Lorre is the serial killer, that you almost wish, like, to make the kangaroo court even more ambiguous that he did not confess. But you just had to, because you had to give Peter Lorre that amazing monologue that he has at the end.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point about, you know, him confessing, giving the audience that satisfaction that they actually caught the guy. Because they could have done the movie where they have the kangaroo court and something bad happens to the guy there. I know in the real movie the police come in, but they could have done it so the audience never actually finds out if that guy was the murderer. Although you did kind of see him at the beginning.
Yeah, you see him at the beginning, so the audience knows that he did it. But I think if you really wanted to stress, which I don't know if this is one of Fritz Lang's major points, but it's one of the things that I get out of the movie the most is the arbitrary nature of mob justice. And there would have been a part of me that would have been even more satisfied if he had not admitted and they had just continued to move forward with the prosecution anyways. But neither here nor there. Yeah, so we definitely get to see all of that stuff towards the end. So speaking of as an actor and a voice actor, what are some of the what did you think of the performances in this film? Peter Lorre, obviously, as the serial killer, Hans Becker, pretty famous performance there.
That he was awesome. And it was, you know, his performance. The actors are always so expendable. It's really the people behind the scenes that create the suspense, in my opinion. But the most suspenseful part of the whole thing was just before the court. I think they spent about at least 20 to 25 minutes chasing him, and he kept disappearing into the shadows. And, you know, there were several moments where you thought they had him, and he had no move left, and then he's gone, you know?
Well, that scene is amazing for a number of reasons. The biggest thing that jumped out at me at that scene is my perspective of suspense flipped. And I don't know that I've ever felt this way in another movie, but my suspense was almost feeling the fear of this serial killer. Not that I empathized with him like as I would later on in the film, empathizing with, you know, somebody that felt like they were under the sway of uncontrollable urges, but more that I felt like the suspense that I was feeling was the fear of getting caught, which is kind of amazing, because this is the bad guy. I want him to get caught, but yet I'm feeling his fear and the impending doom that he's feeling. Partly because it's like you said, the behind the scenes work, but it's also Peter Lorre's acting. I could feel the terror that his character would have been subjected to.
Yeah, and the circumstances of that, you're right. He's a child killer, so he's probably the least sympathetic person on earth. Right?
Yeah, he's a child killer, but not just a child. He's not like just some mass murderer or some war criminal. He's killing these children for sexual reasons, and he's a child molester. So yes, he's literally the. And in fact, this movie plays on that, because he's not only being hunted by the police, he's also being hunted by all the crime syndicates.
Right.
And so he is literally, and they discuss it. They say he's not even a crook. He's a monster. He's the lowest of the low.
Exactly.
And yet somehow during that chase sequence, I feel exactly as you were mentioning, I felt the tension and the suspense.
Well, you know, and because, you know, the good and evil in a good story, there, good and evil is not so easy to determine. You know, it's not like this person's good, this person's evil. The lines are just blended and blurred and gray between good and evil. And so there was something evil about how he was being pursued by the police. There was something evil about the way he was being pursued by, like you said, the crime syndicate. There was just something wrong about the way everybody involved started to lose their principles about the thing and the mob justice that was involved, that he wasn't exactly the bad guy in that moment, even though he was the child killer who was being chased. But the bad guy could have been the people who were chasing him.
And so it isn't just that chasing. If we go back to the beginning of the film, right after the murder happens, so the first thing that happens is the media steps in. And I was just watching, I have the Blu-ray from Criterion, and they have a really great commentary on it. And they pointed out that around the same time when Elsie would have been getting killed by Hans Beckert, the mother of Elsie was getting a magazine sold to her, a serial magazine. And it was suggested in the commentary that this was intentional, that essentially there is some relationship between the sensationalism of fiction, the sensationalism of headlines and newspapers, and the nature of this sort of crime. And so that happens. But then right immediately after the murder happens and the newspapers release the headlines of, you know, the monster of Dusseldorf, well, that's the name of the character in real life. So the serial killer is based off of Peter Curtin, the monster of Dusseldorf. So, but when the headline comes out, you know, child killed, people immediately start acting out. First, you see a scene in like a pub type scenario where people start accusing each other of being the serial killer. And then later on, you see a scene where there's like a rich guy, a petty bourgeoisie, who's helping a child get home. And then, you know, this big hulking proletariat type comes out and threatens him because thinks he's basically the type of crime, as well as the media treatment of it, creates a mass hysteria.
It doesn't result in justice, right? In real justice that people would agree is right and good. Mob justice sometimes does result in the right thing happening. For example, right. Harvey Weinstein. You know, like, he's subject to mob justice. Does he deserve it? Probably so. But the problem is that the consequences don't always turn out good with mob justice. They can be actually terrible for lots of people. And so that's what I think makes the movie so interesting, is that in the movie, the mob justice worked out for everyone's good, because they caught the guy. And then they, you know, gave him something he deserved, although they didn't actually get to murder him, although I think that's what they were planning on doing before the police came in. I think that was obvious. They were going to torture him and murder him somehow, right?
Yeah, it almost felt like they were going to actually just rip him from limb to limb. right. I mean, the way that they were coming after him. Let's just spend time talking about that scene, because it's so powerful. There's a great thing where, so when eventually when Hans Beckert confesses, and Peter Lorre, in one of, you know, just one of the great early performances that I've seen, confesses to the murder of little Elsie, the camera turns to the crowd. So then after the defense attorney makes his argument, and I think we obviously need to talk about that, but then after basically the crowd has said, we don't care, we're going to kill this guy and give him the justice we believe he deserves, the camera is on the crowd, the criminals that are now going to attack this guy, and Then the cops step in, and all of the criminals, without seeing the police, they immediately raise their hand. And you're watching them, and you're realizing, oh, like, these people are now in trouble. And there's this great moment where an arm reaches out, puts its hand on Peter Lorre's shoulder, and says, in the name of, and then a sound bridge happens. Immediately, you switch visually to another shot. It's a fast cut over to the courtroom scene, and it finishes off the earlier sentences, the earlier sentence, in the name of the law. And it's one of the, it's like a really great piece of movie history, or piece of that sound, that transition from silent to sound, where you're connecting the two scenes, not just with the visual cut, but also that, that sound bridge that happens. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Well, and it's, you know, sort of a figurative connection between the kangaroo court and a real court, right? And a real court of law, you know?
And and part of this being that they did have capital punishment in Weimar Germany when this film was made, and there was a real question, because they, it wasn't like America where we just, you know, kill a ton of people. That's not a technical term. I don't know what it, but you know, they didn't use capital punishment very often, but they did use capital punishment in at least three of the sensational serial killer cases. So this was something that that happened rarely, but they were arguing about is the legitimacy of capital punishment.
They were arguing about that in the film, you think?
I believe that that was intentionally something that they were arguing about. So not only the issue with mob justice in general, but the connection of mob justice to even legal death penalty.
Oh, yes. I see what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, does the media attention that a case gets and the public outrage associated with it, does that have an actual and real effect on, say, the prosecutor's election to seek the death penalty, or a jury's election to administer the death penalty? So the mob justice actually in a real court of law is the can be the sort of engine behind somebody getting the death penalty.
And that can – and, you know, taking a step back from current events, thinking back to, like, the 80s. Right when there were all those cases about child molestation that later turned out to be driven by like the daytime talk show hysteria, those murder cases that were satanic cults, that almost all of them turned out to be, you know, pretty weak cases, but a lot of people and a lot of sensational news stories happening around questionable. Crimes with questionable evidence and a lot of it being furthered by this mass hysteria that we're talking about now.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And that's the problem, because in many cases the pitchfork and torch crowd in many cases are right, and the problem isn't that they're right sometimes. The problem is that process has a very real danger of punishing the innocent. Even, well, there's, you know?
Yeah, but I think, so you were getting to a point that's really important, I think, to this film and important to the historical context of the film. So let's go back to that. Film released 1931. I think the Nazi. So first you have Germany loses World War One, and that had very real repercussions that you see in this film. Like, I think one of the homeless guys had a wooden leg, which I think pretty much signified, like, yeah, he was a World War One veteran. And there was lots of that. There was lots of hearkening back to some of the World War military stuff. In fact, I had read somewhere or heard somewhere that one of the things that they wanted to include in this movie was a scene where Peter Lorre's character would have been in World War One and would have connected his current serial murder to the to the killing that he was doing during World War One.
So what, he had post-traumatic stress disorder?
So there's a lot of, yeah, and I don't know if this is something Fritz Lang has mentioned specifically, or if it's just something that people have read into it and that a lot of people agree with. I think Fritz Lang had said this specifically, that yeah, he's essentially, this urge to serial kill was part of being shell-shocked.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, that goes to the insanity defense that was lodged at his kangaroo court, you know, by his lawyer, which, I don't know if this is off topic, but how funny is it that even in a kangaroo court with mob justice and torch and pitchforks and being run by criminals, they still recognize the fundamental right to have a lawyer?
Yeah, I mean, it is funny. This movie has a few funny turns to it that I really like. The kangaroo court having a criminal defense attorney is great. But it's also great that even other criminals, they want a kangaroo court. They want mob justice as well, even though, as the criminal defense attorney points out, you know, everybody here has committed a ton of crimes, including the judge who has 3 murder cases out against them.
Right, exactly. But the criminal defense attorney raises the insanity defense. And, you know, obviously, even a layperson would – you don't have to be a lawyer to recognize that's what he's doing. But as a lawyer, when he starts to talk – and, of course, I'm reading English subtitles, so I don't know exactly what the translation is or – something may have been lost, but the language that that was being used in the subtitles, I mean, you could almost take that from the jury instructions on insanity and replace it, you know, because he was going word for word on what an insanity plea would look like, you know? And so, you know, unfortunately, I don't really know the history of the insanity defense too much, but it's funny to see it being recognized and discussed in a story from, you know, almost, you know, what, 90-something years ago or whatever it is, 80-something years ago, 1931. Right. And it's exactly the same issue, or it's exactly the same language that we would use to talk about it today.
And the argument wasn't over whether or not he was actually insane. Laurie's character, the way that he presents very convincingly his confession, it's pretty clear that this guy is completely lost control. And so the kangaroo court doesn't argue whether or not this guy is insane. They argue about the merit of the insanity defense, essentially saying if he's completely out of control, that's even a stronger case for eliminating him, because he's just going to keep on doing this if he ever gets a chance.
Right. And what do they say to him that's really just a great line? He says, you know, you want to punish me, or you just want to stamp me out or get rid of me or something like that. And then the judge says, no, we want you to stop killing. And the only way for us to accomplish that is to get rid of you.
And I know what you're talking about, because I love that line. He says, specifically, I want to put you out like a bonfire. So he's saying, essentially, they're the same as, like, firemen. And if you think about 1930s cities, fires in cities at that time were insane, because all those houses were made out of wood and they were all, like, packed together, and fire could destroy, you know, entire city blocks in minutes.
Right.
And so he's saying, I want to put you out like a fire. You are a public safety hazard. And we are, you know, the members of this criminal kangaroo court, we are the firemen.
Yeah, exactly. And it's true, you know, and a lot of people today feel that way as well. You know, I mean, that's one of the tenets of criminal justice, right, is prevention. It's not just retribution and punishment, but it's also prevention of future crime, protect the public. That's why we lock people up, or at least that's the theory behind it, is if that they're not on the street, then they're not making more victims out of people.
And it's great. So the criminal defense attorney, I think, has So first he makes the obvious arguments for the insanity defense and saying, hey, look, it's murder if you kill this guy because he did things that are completely out of his control. We should put him in it. This is what we have asylums for. But then he gets pushed to the point because people say, essentially the criminals say, forget that. We're not doing that. But then he gets pushed to the point where he has to say, well, no matter what you guys say, even if you did send him to an asylum, you can't do this. You can't have a kangaroo court. There's no validity to this. We need to have a defense. We need to have this go through the criminal system because this is a human being, and I will not stand by to watch the murder of a human being, which is what they were proposing to do to him, the very crime that this guy is accused of committing. And I thought that was really potent. The focus on this, no matter what he has done, this is a human being. You can't murder him without, this is murder.
Well, and that's a tactic that I use in trials too. And every good trial attorney does it, criminal defense or otherwise, is that, when your defendant walks into a courtroom and finally meets the jury or the judge or whomever's going to pass judgment on him, they don't understand him or her as a human yet. And you have to take concerted efforts to humanize the person, right? And it's just funny to watch a film just pick up on these same themes that the defense attorney literally tries to humanize his client in this film. And I'm thinking to myself as I'm watching, that's what I'm trying to do constantly, is trying to humanize my client, show pictures of my client with his kids, share stories about my client that have nothing to do with the crime. It's just him being a normal person, like a person who has a job, a person who has a mom, a person who, has a beating heart. And the question for the jury is, do you want to put this beating heart in a cage or not? And, it's funny to see that play out in the film, because it just teaches me that these themes that I deal with are not new. They've been around for a long time, and then one of the things I was thinking too, where did they get this impromptu criminal defense attorney who was actually really good? They just went to what did they call a law firm and bring him down? Was he actually an attorney, or did they just say, hey, why don't you play the attorney? So just pick a random guy, and then he got up there and was actually very, very well equipped to do it from a psychological standpoint.
Well, this is the syndicate. They have connections. Don't you worry. They know a guy. They know a guy.
Yeah, they know a guy. But their attorney, it couldn't have been their attorney because he would have been conflicted. This guy seemed to have no conflict at all with defending the guy. So the attorney that they chose actually gave a shit about the case. He wasn't – can I say that on your –
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. I didn't even notice. Yeah. Shit. Fuck. You do the whole thing. I don't care.
Oh, okay. Good. Yeah. He actually cared. They didn't get him some, dump truck attorney who was just going to plead him guilty. They got him a fighter. He was out there fighting for the guy, really trying to win the case. Just came out of nowhere.
I love that when he says, I will not be shouted down, knowing that this came out at a time where the Nazis had just, they didn't win the election, but they didn't, because I don't think Hitler came to power until 1933, but the Nazi party greatly increased their votes in the election that happened during the production of this film. And so the idea of a man at this time, during the Great Depression, after the loss of World War I, as the Nazi party is growing its membership and growing its influence, to have in a film a man yelling against, every element of society, the police and the criminals that are, the mob that's in that dilapidated distillery with him, to stand up and shout out, I will not be shouted down, for this human being granted, but for this person who had done the most heinous crimes, yet he was standing for, like you said at the beginning, that core principle of we are not going to go back to mob justice. We are not going to going back to Old Testament ways of dealing with these things, because that's just not who I am, and I will never allow that. I will not stand by and witness the murder of another human being.
Yeah, exactly. And that guy who did all that seemed to come out of nowhere. They just produced him from thin air. They were like, we need a lawyer, and whoosh.
Yeah, because does he even show? Because there's a slow pan at the beginning where they show just how many people are in the kangaroo court. Do they show, like, can you see him in that shot? I don't remember, because I think you sort of just see him, again, it's like Peter Lorre. Another arm reaches down and says, hey, you know, Peter, maybe you should, hands Becker, maybe you should not give speeches right now and let me handle this.
Exactly.
It is kind of a great moment. So before we go on to, there's a bunch of things I want to talk about, but I do want to take a step back and talk a little bit about, you had mentioned, it's amazing that this comes up 90 years ago. In a movie 90 years ago that somebody is making pretty much the core of the current argument that a criminal defense attorney would make in court, or even really, like, you know, the real reason why you do some of this work, why this is a moral obligation as a just society, that we provide vigorous defense even for people that, you know, are guilty or whatever. Like, that is a moral obligation, that every person gets a vigorous defense before we put a beating heart behind bars. It feels like there's a lot else in this movie that feels like, oh wow, so that's been around for 90 years. The criminal procedure aspect of the first part of the movie blew me away. I was like, oh my gosh. They were doing this back in the 30s when they're doing they put up the fingerprint on the screen and they were doing the handwriting analysis and all of that. That felt to me like, wow, like this is straight out of CSI.
Well, yeah, like silent film CSI back in the day, you know?
Yeah, you almost expected for somebody to come out and say, well, this person probably has a large bump on the back of their head and like some physiognomy, whatever. The thing where they say you can tell whether someone's a criminal by the shape of their skull.
Oh, yeah, that's garbage, right?
But it was an interesting mix of garbage science, but also real detective work, like real contemporary, you know, going door to door, trying to figure out, I think, what was it? He had written notes. But the note was written in a way that you could tell that it had been written on like a rough wood surface. And so they wanted to find writing samples and a rough wood surface that would pin somebody to the crime.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So they were just employing the forensics of the time, right, to see if they could come up with an identification. But, you know, ironically, none of those forensics worked. They didn't get anything out of them. And it was the blind guy, you know, the blind guy recognizing the tune at the end that actually identified the criminal correctly.
It is kind of amazing. That tune is in the Hall of the Mountain King, which I know because I took notes, but I also know because I got it wrong on a trivia thing the other day, which really got me angry because I had already been prepping for this, for talking to you, and I didn't know it. So I will probably never forget that.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah, and then at the beginning, you don't even notice that you notice that he's whistling, but if you've never seen the movie and you don't know the end, you don't understand the significance of that song. So you really don't pay attention to it. And then at the end, when he's whistling again, for some reason, that song's really catchy and just kind of sticks out. And, you know, even before the blind person, at least I had this experience, even before the blind vendor recognized the tune and had that physical reaction, where it was now obvious that that was the same tune being whistled at the beginning, I recognized that tune. That I said, "Oh my goodness, that's the tune. The guy was whistling at the beginning. That's the murderer." And then, you know, so they set up the movie in such a way that I could have identified him. And I'm just kind of a passive watching the movie with like a beer and a thing of popcorn, you know, And I didn't even know, I didn't even really remember that song from the beginning. But then when it came up later, I was like, that's the guy, that song, that's how he's going to get caught, you know? And then that's exactly what happened. So,
and it's so cool because there's a few things that Lang does that's really cool. He uses both the camera and the sound to give you like the subjective experience of individuals in the movie. There's one moment where Lohman, the detective, is trying to remember something. And as he gets closer and closer to remembering this thing, I think it was a previous case that was associated with a certain brand of cigarettes. So not exactly the best evidence, but, you know, they're doing the best they can. Mm-hmm. And so as he's trying to remember, as he's kind of getting, it's on the tip of his tongue, he's getting a little bit closer, the camera actually moves in each time he gets a little bit closer until eventually the camera is right up against him and he's like, ah, now I remember. And I thought that was pretty great. But the other one is the subjective auditory experience, where you can Hans Beckert is trying to fight his urge to sexually assault and kill a young woman. He's trying to fight the urge. And as he's doing it, he starts whistling a little bit, but then he stops whistling. And then as he can't control it, he starts whistling more, and then he tries to stop again. He gets a couple of cognacs and tries to hide out, but then eventually he just has to let it out. The song is too catchy. The urge is too strong, and he just starts whistling and, you know, aggressively. And you know that, like, it's on. Like, this guy is, you know, he can't control it anymore. The beast has been let loose.
Yeah, that's a direct, I never really picked up on that until you just mentioned it, but yeah, that's a direct, you know, symbolism between his whistling is also an uncontrollable urge, and it's his downfall, because had he not whistled, he wouldn't have been caught. Right.
Yeah. And then the other thing that I like about this movie, and then we can probably talk a little bit about, go back and talk a little bit more about the morality and ethics of criminal defense and how that plays in this movie. There's another thing that happens in this movie, which I love whenever it comes up. And so it's another sound bridge, but it's when you take two different – early in the movie, as both the criminals – so the criminals are trying to find this guy not only because they loathe him, because he gives crime a bad name, but the criminals are also trying to find this guy because the police are being extra aggressive, persecute, you know, going into the going into their bars and you know, really being aggressive prosecuting crime because they want to have a show of force. They want politically because they know it's going to be ineffective. They know that this serial killer is probably not hanging out at bars and frequenting prostitutes late at night. But they need to do something because people are so terrified, there's so much hysteria, that they need to do something. And so they start going into all the speakeasies, they start going to all the brothels and just shaking people down. And so the criminals need to respond because it's interfering with their criminal enterprise. It's kind of a great little – it's a little bit ridiculous, but it's kind of this great little thing that now the police and the criminals are in league together trying to find this guy. And the way that they communicate it, going back to some of the really cool things that happen with sound here, is they do that sound bridge where there'll be the safecracker, who, by the way, looks like the most Nazi person. The safecracker, the leader of the criminals, he looks and talks like a Nazi would talk.
Oh yeah, he could have been one of the main characters in the Temple of Doom, you know.
In fact, I read, and I didn't know about this before today, but I read about him that he actually stayed. Peter Lorre and Fritz Lang both left as the Nazis were rising to power. But that guy actually stayed and was very successful under the Nazi regime as an actor and as a theater director.
That's good.
So you know, my initial reaction to him was accurate. But anyways, so you see the police and you see the politicians and you see the criminals, and they're giving this speech about how they're going to hunt this guy down, but they overlap. They cut in between the two, and they make it so that the sentences that they're speaking overlap. suggesting that there isn't that much of a difference, that much of a separation between the criminals and the police.
Yeah, and now that their interests are aligned, it's even more so. And I remember that scene that you're talking about. They are bouncing back and forth between the meetings, the criminal meeting and the police meeting. And, you know, yeah, that's a very powerful scene because they're just, you know, like you said. And I think there's some truth to that today in our society. And that's, again, one of the more amazing things about this movie from, you know, whatever, 80-something years ago on a different continent in a different culture has some of these themes that we see today, present time in our culture. But, you know, the gang mentality of police and the way that they, you know, stick together and the way that they have a brotherhood, you know, if a policeman does something wrong, the other policeman will oftentimes help them cover it up. And so there is a gang mentality with some police departments, and there's a culture of that. And so the question is, how is that different from some of the organized crime or gang crime that we see in our culture? They're more alike than we probably people feel comfortable with, right?
Yeah, I mean, even just in the history of film, I mean, Martin Scorsese, that's one of the major themes of his movies, is the fine line between police officer and criminal, and the connection particularly with like organized crime and some of this. And yeah, and even the depictions of organized crime. So it's a little bit ludicrous. In fact, I watched the movie John Wick 2 recently, and I realized that John Wick 2 specifically stole elements from this movie, or not stole, but they copied elements from this movie, because in John Wick 2 they also have a crime syndicate of the beggars and the homeless. And so clearly that's over the top, and you know, but the other elements of crime syndicate basically as like wayward businessmen, that is absolutely an element in the history of film all the way up to, you know, The Sopranos.
Right.
So that was also interesting to see that depiction, that way of depicting it, has been going back, you know, 90 years as well. And it's not even necessarily American.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Or the organized crime is a business, right? And that's been true for a long, long time, apparently, right?
Yeah, and even whether or not that's really true in real life, or the, you know, because I think perhaps the real truth of organized crime mostly is a lot grimier than that. It certainly is the way it gets depicted in, you know, romanticized visions of organized crime, like in The Godfather, I think, is probably most guilty of that.
Right.
So, okay, so let's... This has been a wonderful conversation, but I definitely want to get back to specifically discuss some of the ethics around criminal defense and some of the things that are brought up in this movie. So we talked about some of the reasons why, and you know where I come from on this. I actually dated a woman who was a criminal defense attorney, and I had to mansplain to another guy at a dinner party once. I probably should have just let her do it. But I got really fired up because I was like, you know, some guy's like, how can, you know, he asked the most trite question. He's like, how can you defend somebody even if you think they're guilty?
Well, I get asked that question. That's probably the question I get asked the most, period, in all contexts of life. That's the question that I get asked the most, hands down. I was asked it last night at a dinner party. I mean, it's almost like I have a rehearsed answer, you know, when I like pull out my you know, dry erase board and I start writing. I'm like, well, where do you want to start? Because there's so much to cover on that question.
You might as well just have a printout that's like, here are my five top bullet points.
Yeah, and me and my wife, you know, we talk about it too, because sometimes if somebody asks that question, first of all, the answer can be kind of uncomfortable for everybody, right?
Yep.
And, you know, sometimes it is. And so now, you know, I'm at the point where if somebody asks me that question, you know, my follow-up is, do you really want to go into this right now? Like, we're all having fun. We're having some drinks.
Right.
And this is a pretty serious question. and I have a lot to say on it, and you don't realize that the answer might take about an hour and a half.
Yeah.
You know, and you might not like the answer.
That's really funny. So you mentioned one point, and one point is like, we want to avoid false positives. We want to avoid, yes, maybe there's a very high percentage of people that when they're brought into a court of justice that have committed the crime. But we want to go the extra mile to make sure that nobody innocent goes away. But I think that's like just like the very surface, issue at hand. The thing that I had said, so the two next level answers, I think, come directly from this movie, right? One is the response that the criminal defense attorney makes, and that is, I can't stand by and witness the murder of a human being. And even if it's not a capital punishment or somebody's going to go away for life or anything like that, don't we as a society owe any single person that we're going to deprive of property or deprive of freedom or deprive of their life, don't we owe them the absolute maximum, most vigorous defense that they can have possible before we do that?
And even the criminals in this movie, and like I said earlier, even the criminals who are involved in the quote unquote kangaroo court at the end of the film, even they recognize the right to a competent defense in this context. And that fundamental right of having not only a defense but a good defense, and one where every rock is turned over, and one where it's the investigation is done and a forensic work is done on the defendant's behalf, is so important in our society. It's more important than healthcare, your legal care. And I make this comparison, I probably said this a million times, but think about this. If you commit a murder and you're brought to trial, the government is going to pay for your legal services, in an abundance of probably $200,000 to $500,000, depending on what you need. You might need a DNA expert. You might need a ballistics expert. You might need a psychologist. You definitely need an attorney. You obviously need an investigator. You need all these forensic services. And you don't have to pay for any of that. There's sort of a legal insurance plan in this country. Now, if you get cancer and you don't have health insurance, you just die. You just die, and that's it. Nobody does anything for you. So our society values these services and these rights more than healthcare, right? More than basic healthcare. And I think the reason for that is because the rights that provide for the financing of a criminal defense case are constitutionally based, and the court system has determined that this is necessary without any voting, without any popular polls. The United States Supreme Court and various appellate courts have established that we're gonna pay for your criminal defense through case decisions. So that nobody voted on it. It wasn't the result of a political process. It was the result of a judicial process. And so, I don't know what that means, but it just shows how important it is and how valued it is in our society.
And so, and rightly so. And from the individual perspective, that's what matters. From the societal perspective, I think that this movie makes a really strong and really clear connection between, if we go down this road, if we go down the road of mob justice and this lynching of this person who's a horrible human being, has confessed to it, really needs to be like kept separate from children and really just from any, from anybody that he can harm, and needs a lot of care. Even for this human being, for our society, if we give in to these urges, if this is the road that we go down, it's, fascism is the next stop. the Nazi Party was right around the corner. And not everybody is, you know, signs up for. In other words, good people don't become fascists because they think, you know, because they're evil people. They do it because they give in to this. They give in to some of these societal urges and societal hysteria, not dissimilar from the personal and individual urges and hysteria that this criminal has undergone. And if we don't really think carefully about how we make sure that justice is kept separate from the mob mentality, then that is like a very, I don't want to say slippery slope, but it's like a short trip to that fascism. And that's probably part of the reason why the Constitution and why courts have built it in there. But I think as time has gone on, I think Lange is making a really strong argument to say, if you guys do this, if you start persecuting people because they're undesirables, or if you start persecuting people because they're Jews, like, this is what's going to happen to us. Or if we do this to this worst person, where does it stop? How are we going to make sure that these other things don't happen afterwards?
Well, and the, you know, the mob justice, the pitchfork and torch crowd, the temptation is strong because in many instances, you can get, you know, you can, it feels so good. It feels so good to find out that somebody was a sexual deviant and victimized women, and then, you know, you are able to punish them immediately without any, you know, swiftly, without any roadblocks. And that feels good to people. And there's a natural tendency to want to do that from a psychological standpoint.
Well, I'll make it personal, for instance. So let's take a step back from what's going on in Hollywood. Let's just look at, I'm a liberal. I'm a Democrat. And just from what I've seen, like, I think DJT, I think that the president of the United States literally should be removed from office and potentially brought up on criminal charges. And I am, like, so passionately feel that. And yet here I am also arguing vigorously that everybody be given, appropriate criminal defense before deprived of liberty. But I am absolutely in the torch and pitchfork crowd when it comes to the guy that I don't like. So I also get, and perhaps this is different from other people, but I also am subjected, I think, sometimes to that same mob mentality and urges, you know, that I really want to make sure that we as a society don't just let loose.
No question. Yeah. And we all have this within us, not just you, everybody. You know, the thing that makes it so powerful is that even though we can step back and look at it from, you know, from a more broad perspective, we can kind of take ourselves out of it and recognize the principles upon which we're acting. You know, that still does not immunize us from acting that way or feeling that way. You know, you can recognize that perhaps this mob mentality is evil and wrong, but you can't stop yourself from partaking in it when it comes to something you feel really strongly about, like Donald Trump. And I think I might be in that same boat with you. But you know, that's what's so interesting about it. That's what's so fundamental about it, is that, you know, fighting this mentality is something you have to internalize and work on within yourself. So it's not enough to, you know, call it out when other people do it and say, you guys are doing this and this is wrong because of X, Y, and Z principle. But it's also important to look within yourself and say, shit, I do this too. In this context, I do the same thing. Why is that? Why is it part of their nature to want to do that? And I think the genius of our system, or at least the principles behind our system, recognize that some aspects of human nature are not good justice, right? So have you seen, you know, this a little, you know, a little off topic here, because we keep talking about the mob and pitchfork crowd, but have you heard of The Orville? It's a new show with Seth MacFarlane.
So I have a lot of friends whose tastes in movies and TV I really respect, that really like that show, but I haven't actually seen it yet.
So, yeah, I've been watching it from the beginning, and I thought going in that it was going to be just a silly Seth MacFarlane, Family Guy, dirty jokes.
The trailers did not look good for that show, and I was totally surprised when people really glommed onto it, because I looked at the trailers and said, this looks ridiculous.
It's awesome. It's nice. It's awesome. And there was an episode. If you want to start with an episode, I mean, you could start at the beginning, but it's not one of those shows where if you don't start at the beginning, you're going to be confused. You're like, what's going? You know, it's so obvious that it's just a total spoof of Star Trek, right? Obviously. So, but there's the social commentary within the show is like so on point and so well done. That you almost feel like you're watching a show that's better than Star Trek at some level. But there was an episode a couple weeks ago where they went to this planet and everybody wore a patch, and it was mandated by law that you have to wear this patch on your, you know, like breast. And there was a like and a dislike button on the patch. And if you get likes, that increased your status in the society, and if you got dislikes, that decreased your status in the society. And then if you got a certain amount of dislikes total, then that was actually a crime. You can't have so many dislikes or else you're sent to jail. And they have this whole criminal justice process where if you get a certain amount of dislikes and you're close to the threshold of going to jail, you have to start your what they call your apology tour, and you get assigned it's awesome, dude. You get assigned instead of a lawyer, you get assigned a PR person who helps you go on my these shows and apologize for whatever it is you've been doing wrong.
That cuts close to the bone, man.
that is so close to the bone.
Yeah, that's funny.
But, you know, it's such a mob mentality commentary, because the folks who in the society who watch the show, if they don't like you, they can just shoot more dislikes at you, and then you go to jail. So if you go and do your apology tour and you say some stuff that's, you know, unpopular, you're going to jail. It's awesome.
So you are in scheduling the show, you told me, so you have a case coming up. You also had some pretty big news recently. You had I don't know if it was an appellate court but you had successfully in your criminal defense work, you had successfully, what was it, exonerated a man who with some DNA evidence that you had been working on, or tell me a little bit more about that.
So yeah, it's not an exoneration case, although, you know, I say that with the caveat that my belief is that the guy's innocent and he was wrongfully convicted. But that wasn't the issue that we litigated in the habeas writ. But essentially, it was the Superior Court. It was not an appellate court.
Oh, okay.
In you know, California, and I think other states as well, you can pursue post-conviction habeas relief in state court. You can do it in any court, actually. Habeas is one of those universal things. You can do it in the federal court. You can do it in Court of Appeal. You can do it in Superior Court. But ultimately, no matter where you do it, it comes back to Superior Court, especially if you have to have witness testimony and blah, 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 blah. But anyway, the issue was that they used this DNA evidence against him at his trial in 2010. At the time they used the DNA evidence, and what it was it was complex mixture DNA. So it's like touch DNA. If you get a sample from, in this case, it was gloves, a pair of bloody gloves, believe it or not. And if you have touch DNA, usually it's a mixture sample of multiple sources, so multiple contributors. You know, there'll be like four or could be even five people in your sample. Mm-hmm. Well, they have ways that they try and determine whether an individual person is included in that mixture sample. And they have calculations they do that are called, you know, combined probability of inclusion or the combined probability of exclusion, and they come up with a statistic. And this statistic might say, you know, it's one out of a billion that it's just pure chance that that the single suspect is consistent with the profile obtained from the mixture sample. So anyway, they had these procedures that they used, but what happened after the trial is that we found out that the procedures weren't scientifically valid. And in fact, there had been controversy in the DNA community about these procedures. And then finally, the FBI promulgated some guidelines that said, you can't do this anymore. This is just not valid science. It's over-inclusive, and many people are being included when they shouldn't. And even if somebody is included and they should have been included, the statistics are overstating the rarity of the match.
Got it.
And so they did away with this procedure, and the San Diego Crime Lab updated its procedures. And so when I found out that this whole controversy occurred, I contacted the crime lab and I asked them to reinterpret the DNA under the new guidelines. And when they reinterpreted the DNA, all the inculpatory evidence was inconclusive at this point.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So essentially they reran the odds, they reran the calculation with the new methodology, and then it came out as like, yeah, might be him, it might not.
Well, they couldn't run the statistic anymore. There was no statistic, because the first step is to determine whether he is a possible contributor. And if the answer to that question is yes, then they ask the question, well, what are the chances that it's just pure chance that he's consistent with this profile?
Oh, but here, when they reran it using the new methodology, they couldn't even pass that initial threshold.
Correct. So they couldn't even say he's a possible contributor. It was now inconclusive.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And of course, with mixture samples, they're highly complex. We share a lot of DNA. So the more people that are in a mixture, the more likely that a random person would, just by pure chance, be consistent with that mixture.
But so what happened for, because I think this wasn't just that, and obviously you've done a lot of work on raising awareness around the new FBI promulgations and the new standards. But I think you also didn't, like, what happened? Didn't you also have a client that was affected by this?
Well, right. My client in the murder case was now inconclusive as to all of his inculpatory samples. And so that's why I filed the writ 2 years ago. And of course, the San Diego District Attorney fought me on it. But finally, it got overturned. And it got overturned based on a Brady violation, which, some folks, I use that word so often that I take for granted that people might not know what it means. But a Brady violation is when the prosecution fails to disclose helpful information to the defense that they have in their possession and control. So if the police interview a witness that exonerates the person or says that, you know, is an alibi for the person,
They have to tell the defense.
Yeah, they have to tell the defense. It's such a simple rule, you know, that if in the course of their investigation they uncover anything helpful, they have a constitutional duty to disclose that. What happened here is that, I remember I told you that the guidelines changed. And I had thought when I initially filed the writ that the interpretation guidelines that basically rendered these samples inconclusive, I had thought they changed after the trial. But when we had the evidentiary hearing, the analyst for the crime lab, it was kind of this big moment, you know, this like Perry Mason moment where it was just like, you know, he testified that the guidelines had changed prior to his testimony.
Oh,
and
wow.
He testified to the old guidelines because he didn't think it was that big of a deal. And he didn't even mention that the new guidelines, one, had changed, and two, would render his testimony meaningless.
So what had happened? So was had your client been in jail those two, like this time?
My client still is in jail. He's been in jail since February of 2010, and he still remains in jail because even though the conviction got overturned, the remedy is that he gets a new trial, and they're going to
retrial.
Going to retry him. So he still remains in custody even now.
Well, there's no question, Matthew. And I sent you a note. I've sent you a note every single time that something like this has come up, where either you've you've won a case for your client, or this news had been. I think this isn't the first time that parts of this news had come out. I always send you a note because you know that I believe you're doing God's work, and you know, I'm just so proud to have you as a friend, have you as somebody, you know, coming out and talk to. Like, I'm just so proud to know you, and so proud that you're doing all this great work.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
With all the stuff that we see in the news sometimes, it's good to know that there are a lot of people out there, you know, dedicating their career to this sort of thing, to helping people and you know, trying to see justice done from all sides. I have many great friends that also do police work, prosecutorial work, and I'm very proud to see all the great work you're doing, you know, for the justice system and for your clients.
Well, I appreciate that. And let me shamelessly use this forum to make one more point about the case, because I think it's really important. The writ that I filed and ultimately won on this issue, on the DNA issue, this was the first of its kind in the nation that I know of. Yes, this has never been pursued in the courtroom before. And so...
And this promulgation by the FBI... This would have happened where many crime labs, many courts across the country had been using this old methodology, and you're saying you're the first person that has brought up, like, hey, you know, we prosecuted this person under this. And in addition, one of the witnesses knew that these new promulgations had been made, and yet we still sent the guy to jail.
That's what happened in this case, but from a more global perspective— The guidelines changed in 2010, and then since then, it took about 3 to 4 years, maybe a little bit longer, for the federal FBI guidelines to be adopted by local crime labs throughout the country. And in fact, the practice of, you know, over-including people or including people when they should not have been including in complex mixture samples was rampant for a long time, most of the 2000s and into the early 90s. And these change in guidelines are sort of evidence that many people still in custody in prison right now serving very long sentences are actually innocent, or even if they're not innocent, had DNA evidence used against them that is no longer valid. And we're in the process now, along with the private criminal defense bar, the public defender's office, and the Institute for Criminal Defense Advocacy, we're in the process of trying to identify cases in San Diego where this same error occurred. But we're just local groups. We don't have a way to review cases nationally. And so, you know, it would be just sort of my hope that people learn about this in other jurisdictions, learn about the work that's been done here on this issue, and recognize that it's an issue in your community and in your jurisdiction as well, and action needs to be taken there. So
that's awesome. Amazing work. And I really hope that this is just the beginning, and more defense bars across the country get to use this to make sure that the people that are in jail for these serious crimes, based off of this DNA evidence we now know is faulty, that we make sure that those people get the proper justice that they deserve. So this is just that's amazing.
Yeah, it's the tip of the iceberg. I mean, I don't know where it's going to go from here, but like I said, I think at the very least, an audit and review should occur on DNA mixture cases.
Matthew, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank you for all of your work. You're doing God's work. Just awesome.
I had a blast. What a fun podcast. I actually listened to a few of them, and very entertaining, and I'm really glad I got to be a part of it. Thank you so much for inviting me on, and I had a super fun time.
Let's do it again soon. Thank you.
All right, my friend.